October 27, 2012, Vrindavan Indian Nectar Devotion, Text 15, Part 2.
Okay, so the last point that we're going over here deals specifically with the gopis. And just, they can come if they want or not come if they want. That's up to them. And, or you can close the door if they're disturbing you. And they're, you know, what does this mean by lust? So this is particularly important because it can be so much misunderstood. Now, we talked a little bit about this yesterday because someone asked the question about, you know, when can you read the Ras Lila chapters? Remember, we were talking about that yesterday? Everybody remember? Yes? What did we say yesterday? Who can recap that for me? When we say, guys, you can wrestle outside, please.
He's taking all the sweets.
Yes, boys. You can wrestle outside for the sweets, okay, if you want to do it. But not in the classroom. Thank you. Hare Krishna. You're all manifesting your ecstasy as cowherd boys here fighting over the sweets, but you can do that. And the cows are right there, so you go play with the cows. Have fun. Well, what did we say yesterday about reading?
Yeah, just reading this through people on the road.
Yes. Yes, we're distributing Krishna book to everyone. And what else?
You don't have to be in Raghunuga Bhakti.
You don't have to be in Raghunuga Bhakti to read Krishna book. And what else? What else? Yes.
Prabhupada didn't appreciate the Gopi Club mentality.
Yes. What was that mentality?
Just reading that.
Just reading that and not reading anything else. So we read systematically. And what else? What is special about Srila Prabhupada's presentation of Krishna with the gopis?
No one can misunderstand.
It's almost impossible to misunderstand. I mean, you would really have to work hard to misunderstand from reading Srila Prabhupada. Why? Why is it? What does Srila Prabhupada do that makes it so easy to understand properly?
Purports.
His purports. What about Krishna book?
No, it's a long purport.
It's almost like one long purport. So he's interweaving the stories with philosophy. So we should be very careful because many of the books of the Goswamis are just the stories. There's no philosophy. There's no purports. So when do you think you could read things like that?
When we are well versed with Prabhupada's philosophy.
Hmm?
When we are well versed with Srila Prabhupada's
philosophy. Be very well versed with Prabhupada's philosophy. That would mean what specifically? You should have done what? All of Srila Prabhupada's, at least main books. Two hours, that's nice. I know one guru who suggests that. I said that he does that. I didn't say that. So, but I've read all of Srila Prabhupada's books. You know, at least all the main ones. That means all of Bhagavatam, all of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna book, Bhagavad Gita, Nectar Devotion, Nectar Instruction, Isha Upanishad. And have studied them. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati gave an amount of years. Do you remember what I said?
He said in one book up to 15.
15. It's about 15 years. So that was actually at Radhakund, when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was giving lectures at Radhakund. And he was saying, you know, by the time you've been chanting for 15 years, you should be able to read these things. But, you know, if you still haven't read Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita after 15 years. Well, I met someone the other day who's been a devotee for many years and has never read any of Srila Prabhupada's books. So it doesn't happen. But one should be very thoroughly versed. And then, okay, now I've read all of Srila Prabhupada's books, now I'll just read this? Now I'll just read Rasa literature?
You always go back.
To keep reading Srila Prabhupada's books. Keep reading Srila Prabhupada's books. So So even if you're at the point where you can read, you know, Madhava Mahotsava and Ujjvala Nilamani, Ujjvala Nilamani is like volume 2 of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. You know, and without misunderstanding, you want to also keep reading Srila Prabhupada's books. What other caveats would we have? What other conditions would there be? So if you're going to be reading, the very Rasika literature, so you also keep reading Srila Prabhupada's books. You've already read all the Srila Prabhupada's books. You've been chanting for many years. What else?
Follow the
four regular principles. Yes, that sounds like a good idea. Do we have either, if the AC is off, then we need windows open. You notice it like in, yeah, it's off. No, not the doors. You know what happens if you have the door open?
You can put it on
the AC. You can put it on. You lock it up, but then you can sit on the other side where there's no direction.
Yeah, if maybe
you
just.
Can get suffocation.
Yeah, it becomes very. There's too many people in the room, and we use up all the oxygen in the room very quickly.
You can sit here if he has a problem.
Yeah, there's space here for.
There's space here. You can sit here.
Okay, thank you.
And
I don't want to make sure.
No, no, it's fine. We don't have assigned seats. It's fine. Anywhere you sit is fine. No problem. Okay, so to follow the regulative principles, because one of the hallmarks, we have lots of extra cushions here too. One of the hallmarks of the sahajiyas is they're not following the regulative principles. They're reading this Rasika literature, and they're also having illicit sex and taking intoxication and so many things. And also to keep reading thoroughly. We were giving the example of Gadadhar Pandit and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and what were they reading? Dhruvan and Prahlad. You know, and Prabhupada relished all the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada wasn't just relishing the 10th canto. Prabhupada was relishing the whole Bhagavatam. And the Acharyas, they relish everything. Prabhupada says we shouldn't neglect one drop. At the same time, of course, it's natural, we'll study this more on Tuesday, that as your personal proclivity for Krishna awakens, you're going to be especially meditating on the leelas that pertain to your relationship with Krishna. That's natural. So discussing this idea of this, how do we know that this lust, that what's called lust or kama of the gopis, is not like material lust? First of all, everyone knows that material lust is more or less disgusting. Even though every conditioned soul is attracted by it, we all know it's disgusting, don't we? It's interesting, isn't it? We all know it's disgusting and embarrassing. It's something that we all feel very embarrassed about. Of course, in modern society, they're trying to break this, and they're trying to have everybody act like the monkeys in Vrindavan. Right? In modern cities, if you have the misfortune, so sometimes I stay at the Soho Street Temple, and there in the summertime, if the windows are closed at night, it's very hot. But if the windows are open, it's very noisy. So one night when I was sleeping, I had the windows open, so it wouldn't be so hot. In the middle of the night, I had to get up and close the window. And in closing the window, I saw what was happening on the street. And I thought, oh, better to just leave the windows closed. So what's happening now in the modern world is people are being encouraged to behave without shame, without a feeling of embarrassment, to behave like animals. Just like dogs and the monkeys and the cows. They don't have any shame about sexuality.
So they want to serve Krishna's senses, the basic senses, not their own.
Yes. Why is sexuality so embarrassing and disgusting? What makes it disgusting?
It's very selfish.
It's very, very selfish. And I mean, I'm going to add, I understand that it's difficult. By the way, it's difficult for me too, okay? This is not easy for me, and especially when you're in a female body, it's particularly difficult. And I'm telling you this because I'm asking us to do something that's a little difficult, but I think it's important. And I wouldn't do this myself if I didn't think it was very difficult for me to do this. It's extremely difficult. Of all the things I do in preaching, this is the most difficult. Nothing I do is more difficult than this.
to talk about this topic, but it has to be talked about. You can't not talk about it. So what is it that makes lust disgusting? Why is it shameful? Why are we all so embarrassed about it? You know, they say in the modern society, well, stop being embarrassed about it. Just be open about it. But it's horrible. What's horrible about it?
Because the body is an embarrassment to the soul.
Well, the body in general is an embarrassment. I remember I was at Bhaktivedanta Hospital and I was really sick and I was vomiting. And I looked at the Ayurvedic doctor who was with me and I said to her, this body is so embarrassing. You know, for the soul, it's such embarrassment to be in this body. So that's part of it. Part of it is just that the body itself is just really embarrassing.
Forgetting Krishna.
You're forgetting Krishna. You're thinking just that I am his body. Ravindasrupa explained it really nicely. You're becoming just a slave to your body. Materially speaking, we were talking yesterday about the happiness of Vairagya, right? I mean, really, if there's any material happiness, if material happiness exists at all, it's in Vairagya. That's the only place you're really going to find it. It's sufferable, it's not spiritual. But that's the only place you're really going to find happiness. And sex desire is the opposite of that. You become a slave to the desires of the body. You get to the point that you can't resist them anymore, that the body's telling you what to do. I mean, this is why it's actually enjoyable. Who here has ever done like a full nirjal fast? Anybody here ever done a full nirjal fast? So there's some pleasure in not being a slave to the body, isn't there? Isn't there? You find that? That even if you feel hungry and you feel thirsty, it's pleasurable to be able to say, no, I'm not going to do what you say. No, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to sleep. I'm not going to eat. Isn't that you've experienced? Yes?
Yes.
Yeah. There's a sense of freedom. And it's miserable feeling like a slave. And then what does sexuality bring you? It brings you attachment. But it's not an attachment that just fills you with unlimited joy all the time. It's a very troublesome attachment. You know, if it's illicit sex and you've always got to be wondering, when am I going to be able to find a partner? Is this partner going to leave me? When is this partner going to leave me? Do they actually love someone else? Am I going to get some disease? Am I going to have a baby that I don't want? And is society going to find out? Am I going to get in trouble? And so forth and so on. So it's filled with all this anxiety. But even in married life, then you're also wondering, you know, does my husband actually like me? Does my wife actually like me? Maybe they're angry at me. Maybe they won't be happy with me tomorrow. How am I going to maintain everything? It's not just sweet. Because it's all based on exploitation. It's interesting, there's this very famous book about men and women relationships. Sold millions of copies. And the author has a score, how do men keep score, how do women keep score? You know? And basically everybody's calculating. This is in all material relationships, but we're calculating, okay, I've done this much for this person, they've done this for me. And if you hang around in families, especially if they're not your family, so you'll notice. If it's your family, you may not notice because you're wrapped up in it. But as I travel, I stay in temple ashrams or I stay with families usually. And often when I stay with families, you hear this kind of thing. You know, well, I took out the garbage and I cut the grass. What did you do today? Yeah. Well, I cooked the meal and I watched the kids and what did you do? You just come home and sit down and space out. You know, people they're keeping score. And people who write books on how to have a happy marriage, they talk about, you know, okay, the man should know how the woman keeps score, and the woman should know how the man keeps score. And that way you can try to keep the other person happy. And it's this constant thing of, you know, how can I get a little bit more than I'm giving? You know, how can I make it a little bit more in my favor?
And it's also a lot about manipulation and control, isn't it? How can I be so attractive that I can manipulate and control another person to do what I want? And the whole thing is nasty. Of course, it can be used for Krishna, just like food. And then it becomes spiritual, just like anything else. Just like food and clothing and anything else. That's possible. And it has a different nature. Prabhupada said in Grahastha Ashram, sex can be a yajna, like offering for Sodom, and one can see Krishna in that yajna. But that's different. What's nice about it then is that you're offering it to Krishna, and Krishna is pleased. Just like with prasadam. I mean, eating is also disgusting, if you think about it at all. But when you offer to Krishna, then it becomes transcendentally enlivening. But so this attitude of the gopis, what's different about this attitude between Krishna and the gopis? Oh, we should also say, with material sex life, very interesting, I remember when I had to do, it was for one of my doctoral classes, it was a class about how to look at a school district as one system. And each of us had to do a report on different parts of the system. And I was assigned to do a report on finances. So I had to interview six financial directors in six different districts and make a presentation. And that was fun because the professor said we had to use as many of the senses as possible in our presentation. So I decided I was going to use smell and taste, not just audio, visual, and kinesthetic. And so I had one devotee make a lime green pie, several green lime pies, and then we decorated them with symbols of money, because it was about, this is a little side, this has nothing to do with nectar devotion, but just fun. And we cut it up into pieces, and as part of the because we can talk about that with money, everybody wants a piece of the pie. Right? So when we was talking about money, we gave everybody some prasad, so that was really nice in that presentation. But anyway, to get back to the point. So when I interviewed all of the members of the leaders of the financial for each of the districts, so many of them said to me, the two things that will take down a leader are sex and money. They said, those are the two things that will just destroy. And after I heard that, I thought, wow, a lot of what we consider morals and ethics has to do with sexuality. A lot. If people talk about morals and ethics, a lot of what they talk about is how do you handle your sexuality. And so, you know, a lot of what makes sex desire so nasty and disgusting is that people will do a lot of harmful and violent and cruel things because they're being motivated by sex desire. I think half of all murders in America are between sexual partners. I'm sure that's true in most places, except where there's some sort of violent terrorism going on. So how does it become, how does it turn from the, you know, conjugal lust to the ghastly lust?
From lust comes anger.
Yeah, from lust comes anger. It's very connected. And from anger comes bewilderment, memory, and delusion. And people do crazy things under the influence of sexual desire. Crazy. Crazy. They abandon their children. They abandon their spouse. They ruin their careers. Bless you. Isn't it so?
It's also a huge industry. It's become a huge industry.
Yes, and oh, horrible. Horrible, where they're treating people like things. Actually, I ended up giving a class in my Bhagavatam class about the verse in the Paranjana story about the Paranjana goes hunting and killing animals, and this is compared to exploiting women. And I was talking about why people eat meat, because they see the animal as an object. They don't see the animal as a living being. And sexual desire is very much like that for most people. Not for everybody, but for most people. They're just seeing the other person as an object. This is just an object to satisfy my desires. You know, I even got a letter not too long ago from someone trying to be a devotee. And he was saying, you know, when I got married, I just got married because I was overwhelmed by lust, and I was having sex all the time. And then after a while, when I started getting into Krishna consciousness, then I was forced to beat my wife all the time. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Who's forcing you? And now that I just see that she won't be a devotee, so now I just figure I should leave, even though I have a 2-year-old son. And I wrote back, I said, your wife is not an object to either exploit or hurt or desert. You know, and this is the, but we find this is the mood, just using people as if they were, you know, an object. And Prabhupada in that purport, he talks about that. He says, people think women are a mercantile commodity that you can just pay a price for. You know, just like you go and you just buy something. You buy a watch, and if you want, you can just leave it someplace. Sexual lust often makes us into thinking like that, thinking of another person, just the way the meat eaters think of the animals. That let me enjoy at the expense of this other living entity. So what is the difference? Of course, we try, as human beings, we try not to be like that. We try to have our sexual relationships to be pious and caring and mutual and respectful. We certainly try to do that, but it's difficult. It's almost like we're going against the current unless you're really dedicated to Krishna. Yes?
I'm just wondering, is like material conditioning, is that like an excuse? Because, I mean, a lot of people are frustrated and become very sad, brokenhearted, like through this whole thing.
Yeah.
And if they were educated in the knowledge of it, they may like feel relieved or just they're like, I mean, because it comes on very harsh when explained.
It is very harsh. But we can go on, actually I have a whole presentation on this. But now we're going to go to the not harsh part. And the reason I'm trying to be harsh is because in this particular chapter, we're distinguishing that what's happening between Krishna and the gopis is not that. So that's why I'm taking this particular tact today. Because otherwise someone may look at Krishna and the gopis and think, oh, it's like that. Krishna's just some lusty boy who's exploiting all these women. And people think like that because Krishna didn't marry these gopis. He didn't marry the gopis. He wasn't. They were not only did he not marry them, they were married to somebody else. So materially, that is the worst. That is the worst. Because I don't get in trouble for this one. I got in trouble for this before. But anyway, Hare Krishna. So, you know, in the Shastras, a man could marry more than one wife. So if a married man was attracted to another woman, he could marry her. But generally, a woman couldn't marry more than one husband. There's some exceptions. There's Draupadi, there's Maricha, there's also another woman, Bhagavatam, who had 49 husbands. But generally, a woman wouldn't marry more than one husband. So if a woman was married in love with another man, then that was the worst. And the man's not actually taking care of her. So the person who's taking care of her, she's not with him, she's with somebody else. So that's the kind of people have criticized Krishna for this, haven't they? Yes, they do. Particularly I see in India, much more so in the West, where they don't know anything about Krishna, and the first thing we tell them about Krishna is from Prabhupada. Of course, more and more now people are hearing about Krishna outside of Srila Prabhupada, even in the West. So why is the relationship between Krishna and the gopis not this nasty thing?
I think
and who is Krishna trying to please? Is Krishna just trying to please himself? Krishna is trying to please his devotees.
He can't even repay their debts.
Yes. Now, you see, we try to imitate that in this world. In this world we think, yes, I'm just going to serve you, but it's not like that. It's not what's really going on. And you know it's not what's really going on, because then people will start to say, what about me? What have you done for me? The fact that it's actually selfish comes out again. But what's happening between Krishna and the gopis, is what we wish and pretend that sex life was in this world. You know, the stories, the romance, the conception of it,
as something romantic and beautiful and loving and giving and caring and infinitely pleasurable that goes on happily ever after. But the material stuff is not. I'm sorry, it just isn't. You know, even if you've had wonderful sex life, it just isn't like that. It doesn't, is it? Anybody have sex life that just keeps getting better and better and better and better forever and is just full of love and light and peace and harmony and beauty all the time? Yeah, it's been Krishna. But for them, it's actually like that. Their pleasure is always increasing. Their love is always increasing. Their beauty is always increasing. Their giving is always increasing. It's the real deal. It's the real, it's not the fake thing. It's just like we go, and I've given this example before, you go to the supermarket and you buy chemical food. And then somebody will think, oh, real food. But real food is different. You can taste the difference between real food and fake food. So with the gopis and Krishna, that's the real thing. And that's what we're looking for. So what do we do with our material sex desire? Do we kill it? Can you kill it? Is it possible? Where is it coming from?
Love of God. Love transformation of God.
Yeah. Our sex desire is part of the soul. This is in Bhagavatam 5:25. 5. And taking the Tirtha Majjhavila 8:138. But Prabhupada says sexual feelings are part of the spiritual body and is part of the soul. So this urge that we have in this world, you can't kill it. It's actually something real. And its original form is something nice and is something beautiful and is something wonderful and is something giving and is something loving. It's just like if you buy this bottle of, you know, juicy juice and it's got just a little juice flavor. But real juice is wonderful. So the real thing is wonderful. Now, by the way, how is the real thing experienced by people who aren't, because here we're talking specifically about the gopis, or also we'll talk about the queens of Dwarka. So we can understand that those who are in the conjugal rasa with Krishna, they have the original form of sexuality. What about the other devotees? What about Krishna's parents and Krishna's friends and the cows and everybody in Vaikuntha? How do they manifest this original form of sexuality?
They're still love.
Yeah, but how are they particularly this? Does anybody know?
Using it to have Krishna as their child?
No, but particularly this.
You mean lust?
Particularly sexuality. Because mm-hmm. It's part of the soul.
Service. Service?
But service to do what? What's the aim of their service? To please Krishna. Okay, if you're pleasing Krishna, what's Krishna's pleasure potency called? Ladini. Who's that? Radharani. As soon as you're pleasing Krishna, what are you doing?
Pleasing Radharani.
Yes, by doing what? As soon as you're pleasing Krishna, you're involving the Ladini Shakti, which means you're doing what?
You're bringing lust to Krishna's senses.
You're bringing Radharani and Krishna together. Yes. Suppose you're Hanuman, what are you doing?
Sita.
You're bringing Sita and Ram together. Even if you're in Vaikuntha, you're pleasing Lakshmi Narayana. That's why if you really chant Hare Krishna, you can feel a happiness that is the original form, and therefore you lose interest in the perverted form. Because we're part of Krishna. Part of Krishna, right? Are we part of Krishna? When you bring Radha and Krishna together, when you bring Sita and Ram together, when you bring Lakshmi and Ram together, then that is the original. That is the original position of the jiva, and that is how we actually enjoy. has wonderful purports in 8138, by the way, 8138. Prabhupada saying that this spiritual sex desire is not temporary, it's eternal, and it keeps getting better and better and better and better. So even the devotees who are in Vaikuntha, and even the Vrindavanika devotees who are not in the conjugal rasa, directly with Krishna, this is what they're enjoying by pleasing Krishna. But those in the conjugal rasa, they're particularly enjoying this with Krishna. So that is our whole process of bhakti yoga. Our process of bhakti yoga is not to kill this thing. Because you can't kill it. If you try to kill it, what will you become?
Madness.
You'll go mad or... Yes? You'll go crazy, you'll fall down, or you'll become...
Mayavadis.
Or... Hard-hearted. Doesn't work, my dear friends. Don't do it. Don't try to kill it. Turn it back into love. And that is this whole process of nectar devotion. And just as a little aside, what do you do with this thing in this world while you're turning it back into love? While you're busy turning this lust back into love, what do you do with the remaining lust part in this world? What do you do with it? You've got to do something with it. Can't kill it. Yes? Not possible. That is not possible. No, it is not.
What you cannot.
You cannot.
You don't have to feed it. It's like in the low.
Okay, you cannot take this energy and not act on it. Impossible.
You can't do it.
Yes. So in the grahastha life, you can use it for Krishna conscious children, and you can also use it for the on the emotional level between husband and wife. Right, woman is compared to butter, and man is compared to fire. When you put this, we like butter and fire. What do we do with butter and fire? That's very nice.
Make ghee.
Thank you. We make ghee. And what do you do with ghee? You put it into the
yagya.
You put it into the yagya. So we like ghee. We have nothing. We have no problems with ghee. Now we do have a problem with a mess. So if you just take butter and put it on the fire, it makes a mess. Big mess. So if you want to make ghee, you have to have the butter inside of a
pot.
Okay? So, and you have to then make proper ghee. So married life, the ghee is children, and the ghee is the process of the reciprocation of love between husband and wife, the nice emotional dealings between husband and wife, the impetus to make money for the society. And what's the ghee of the renounced order? You don't know what the saffron color is? You know what it says in Bhagavatam? The saffron color? It is the color of the?
Renounced.
Of the fire. It's the color of the yagya. You are a walking yagya. You are a walking sacrificial fire. And where do you want your ghee when you are a renounced order? You want it to be where? You bring the energy where? To the brain. To the brain. So those who are in the renounced order, they should also have this ghee. What is their ghee?
Philosophy,
study. Preaching. Preaching, you see the whole world as your family. You don't have just one children, two children, three children. You have the world as with you. Prabhupada said renunciation means you broaden the scope of affection. What is the sex desire? What is it? It's union. It's connection with life. Right? Correct? Connection with life, pleasure, and creation. So we're not against this energy. You cannot kill this energy. You cannot say, I'm not going to have connection with life, I'm not going to have pleasure, I'm not going to have creativity. You can go ahead and try. Good luck. Tell me how you do. You can do it. It's part of the soul. So you have to use it. And there's a way that the grahastas use it, and there's a way that the renunciates use it. But you have to use it. And then you turn it back into prema. You turn it back into prema.
Is there a difference in short, when you preach, there's 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, 5 minutes there. But when you're in a marriage, like you're like spending a long time and
Can be. But the renounced person should be getting also this pleasure of yoga, of connection with life, and with creativity, with study. They should also be getting that. That's the energy goes, Prabhupada says, the energy physiologically, it should go to the brain, and it produces tejas and ojas. You were saying brilliant, right? Weren't you saying? Didn't you say?
Yeah, brightness.
Didn't you say? Was it you? Early in the class. You don't remember what you said. Somebody said. It was someone at that side.
Brightness from the soul. That,
yes. So this effulgence.
Was that
you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, somebody on this side of the room. Okay. But now you moved over there, so you confused me. Yes. So I thought it must be him. Sorry. I'm praising him for your stuff. That's good. Yes.
I still don't understand, because if you are lusty and you're married to somebody, that means you'll be
you've got to do something with it, my dear.
Yeah, you do.
You cannot kill it.
Wait a minute, just let me finish.
Okay.
What I'm saying is, if you are like in touch with your whatever lusty feelings and you do get married, you can't just have kids all the time. That's what I'm saying. So what do you do with that lust?
First of all, why can't you have a lot of children?
Well, because you're having
a lot of sex. I'd like to know why you can't have a lot of children.
Because you want to advance spiritually, you want to learn.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur had 13 children.
Pardon?
Bhaktivinoda Thakur had 13 children.
Yeah, but we're not Bhaktivinoda Thakur.
Anyway, there's no reason why you can't have a lot of children.
Money,
expenses. No reason why you can't have a wife. Should I tell her?
That doesn't inspire me, though.
Should I tell her?
Yeah, tell her. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't, not in this age. No one has many kids in this age.
Should I tell her?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, my son has 8 children.
Okay. Your son's a very great...
And I know lots of devotees who have like 5, 6, 7 children in age. I do. Lots of
children. But what if you don't want to have that many children?
Then you have to use the energy for something else.
And if you're lusty, 8 times is not that much sex.
Then you have to use the energy for something else. Because my point is, you cannot not use the energy. You can't.
No,
it's spiritual. So you've got to use the energy for something.
But my point is, for a lusty person, having 8 children is not that much.
But sex is not the only...
It's not the only manifestation of using... Gross sex is not the only manifestation of using an energy. Otherwise, there couldn't be renunciates. Renunciates can also... Confirmed. Renunciates can also use that energy. They are.
There has to be some control in the situation.
Control means, what do I do with it?
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, but you can't kill it this moment.
No, I didn't say you
can't.
I said you don't act upon it. There's a difference.
There isn't a difference.
Yes, there is. You transform it.
But when you say you don't act upon it, that means you kill it. What you do is you do act upon it, but you use it.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Okay, you have to recognize what it is.
You diverge. That's what I mean.
You use it properly. It's just like if you have money. You don't take your money, I hope, and burn it. If you're going to burn your money, I know lots of people you can talk to who'd be happy to take it for you, so you wouldn't have to burn it. So you don't, and you can't anyway. It's part of the soul. You cannot take this energy and burn it. You just can't.
I'm not saying that you have to burn it.
So you have to find a way to engage it. Is my point. You must engage it.
And sex is not the only way.
Gross sex is not the only way to engage it. It can't be. It's impossible for it to be. Because Prabhupada talks about how the traditional brahmachari knew how to raise that physiological energy, not just psychological, but physiological, biological energy to the brain through yoga. So one should recognize what that energy is and know what to do with it, but never try to kill it. It won't work. And you can do whatever you want, but don't try to kill it. It won't work. It just won't work. If you try to kill it, the results will be either you'll become hard-hearted and angry and bitter, or you'll have a fall down. pretty much guaranteed. You cannot just kill it. Yes?
Didn't you know what? Prabhupada did mention actually to Giraj Swami that all these urges, not just sexual urges, but eating, this like an itch, and you have to tolerate it.
That's what all human beings have to do some repression to some extent. That's just like what we were reading back. Thank you. Okay. Actually, the cultivation of knowledge or renunciation, which are favorable for achieving a footing in Krishna consciousness, may be accepted in the beginning, but ultimately they may also come to be rejected. So when you're a neophyte devotee, you're going to have to rely a little bit on repression. But if that's your main method, it will fail. You can take my guarantee on it. You can record my words and write it on your wall.
It's not 100%. It's not 100%.
It should be actually as little repression as possible. But in the beginning, we all have to do some repression of some things. I mean, you can't be a human being without repressing some things. You can't just say whatever you think. You can't just steal whatever you like. I mean, there's some repression. But if the way you're going through life not stealing is by repressing, if that's your method for not stealing, that's not going to work. Does that make sense to everybody? No. If the reason that you're not stealing all the time is that you actually, your desire to steal is overwhelming and you're just sitting on it all the time, it won't work. Some repression sometimes is necessary. You can't function in a civilized society. And in the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may have to be tolerating an itch for this thing or that thing or the other thing. But if that's your main method, it will not work. Right here. Renunciation, which are favorable for achieving a footing in Krishna consciousness, may be accepted in the beginning, but ultimately they may also come to be rejected. It's just, in the long run, it will not. It will respond to it for you. Yes?
Srila Prabhupada indicated that in order to control this urge, one should engage in deity worship.
Ah, why? Yeah. So why will deity worship be very effective? You're bringing Radha and Krishna together.
Is very intimate?
It's very intimate. Or you're worshipping Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu is Radha Krishna. What you're doing in the processes of bhakti is you're awakening the original pleasure. That's what you're doing. And then what are you doing until you're perfect? You have to do something with the remaining material part while you're perfect, right? Everybody understand what I'm saying? I'm transforming it, and as I'm transforming, I've got some left. And that stuff that's left, you cannot just tolerate it. You have to do something with it. You have to. I mean, we've seen so many examples of people who just try to repress it. And you become either hard-hearted, or you fall. Can't do it. You have to use it in some way. I have a whole nice presentation on this, if you're interested. We'd have to have an extra class. We'd have to have some extra time. But I have a whole hour presentation on this with all kinds of posts from Prabhupada and all kinds of cool things on the projector. So if you're interested, let me know. We could do that next week.
That would be nice.
Can we just decide to do that?
What?
Can we just decide to do that?
We'd have to have a general vote, and then you have to tell me when, because our last classes are Tuesday through Friday. So we'd have to have a time to do that. Actually, I ended up making this presentation because I was asked in New Zealand to just give a morning Bhagavatam class on 525.5, where Prabhupada says that sexual feelings are in spiritual bodies. And I looked at that and I said, oh, do I have to talk about that? Well, it's in the purport. I guess I'm going to talk about it. And so I made a Bhagavatam class on it, and at least 30 people came up to me after the class and says, you have got to make this into a presentation and teach us all over the movement. And then later I presented it to the UK youth at a retreat in Italy. And I had especially some of the very, very senior devotees who were there came up to me and said, if people had preached like this from day one in Krishna consciousness, we would have solved so many problems. And then recently I also gave the seminar in Vrindavan. And I got the same kind of response. So I'm getting still, frequently people are asking me for
for copies of it. Actually, I just had a member of the GBC ask me to work with a group to put together a booklet on this topic and see if we can be of help for the devotees. But the main thing I wanted to emphasize today in this class was that we should not think that the gopis and Krishna are having the kind of relationships that people have in materialistic life. That's not what it's about. They're not having some ugly, shameful, dirty, exploitive, immoral relationship. They are having the kind of relationship that people talk about in fantasy and in idealism, that people think they're going to have in this world, and it never quite works out that way. That's the relationship that they're having, where the love keeps getting better and better and better, and where each of them is only thinking about how to please the other. Krishna is just thinking how to please the gopis are just thinking about how to please Krishna. It's actually love. It's actually love, and where they're experiencing both, total oneness and total individuality and giving. All right. Had not intended to do that, but that's cool. Is that all right? So did I end up balanced in the end? Was it balanced enough in the end, Mr.?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I wanted to start, the reason why I wanted to start with the very strong negative about the material was because the point in this chapter is that Krishna and the gopis is not like that. And we see that, don't we, people thinking it's like that?
Yeah.
People painting pictures, like Prabhupada said, painting pictures in some modern style of some licentious thing or depicting somehow Radha. And especially, I think we run into that here in Vrindavan. But it's happening more and more all over the place. And there are people now all over the world who are preaching very strange Sahajiya philosophies in the name of Krishna consciousness and in the name of Srila Prabhupada. And it's something that we really have to be careful of. But we don't want to be so careful of it that we never read Krishna book and that we don't aspire for Raghunandan Bhakti. Yes, Prashant.
One important point also is that Krishna
Consciousness
is devotees are not necessarily the way of the relationship. He's the only Purusha and they know the Prakriti. In this world, we take turns to think that we are the Purusha.
Oh, very nice point, yes. We could talk about that at length, actually, how actually we're all Prakriti, but we're trying to pretend. Okay, this life I'll pretend on the Purusha, you pretend your Prakriti. Now this life I'll pretend on Prakriti. We go back and forth trying to pretend. But actually everyone's trying to be the Purusha. Even those of us in women's bodies, we're trying to be the controller. We're trying to get the men to be so attracted to us that they lose their sense and do whatever we want. And then we get disgusted that they're manipulated by us and we kick them in the face. So that goes on also among the so-called Prakriti. Yes?
I just heard from somebody that funny comment. He said whoever brahmacharis help addressing the Shamsudha, they change the ashram to the ashram.
Oh, I don't think that's true. Actually, the way to be a real renunciate, if you really want to be a renunciate, you have to be at a platform where you're strongly getting your pleasure in life from taking care of Radha Krishna and chanting Hare Krishna. So you have to be using that energy in preaching and in study, but you also really have to be. You have to be more on a platform where you're really getting that pleasure from where the real source of pleasure. Brahmacharis are not, when we say brahmacharis, it would just be people in the brahmachari ashram. But brahmachari vanaprastha sannyas. If you're in a renounced ashram, you can't just be a frustrated person. I mean, you can be, but that's not a renunciate. I mean, the real renunciates are joyful. And they're satisfied. They're not just frustrated. They're not just tolerating their itches all the time. They're satisfied. And why are they satisfied? Yes, thank you. They're satisfied because they're using the material side of the energy in Krishna's service and they're getting their pleasure from the spiritual energy. Well, have to be. Okay, attachment to devotee, is the right attachment or not? That depends. If
just like Kunti said, sever my tie of affection from my relatives, the Pandavas and the Vrishnis. So it depends. Are you attached to devotees because you think, oh, this devotee is in a powerful position, and if I'm attached to this devotee, then I'll get something from them. Even what you think spiritual can be like that, you'll think, oh, if I hang around this devotee, then I can steal some of their shakti. You know, that's not spiritual. You know, if I hang around this devotee, then they'll give me some political favors and I'll get some free burfi. I'll get to sit in the front row, or I can steal their shakti, or something like that. So you can have a materialistic association with devotees. That's possible. Just like you can read the Bhagavatam professionally to make money, you can, as Bhaktisiddhanta said, you can use the shalagram to crack nuts. So just because you can associate with devotees and go to see Superman movies, I mean, maybe it's actually spiritual if you're associating with the devotees to please Krishna. Yes?
What is the person with spiritual guidance?
Hmm? Yes, but not to steal. Okay, this I'm going to answer the next time, because this is about being ready for Raghunuga Bhakti, and that we'll talk about next class. Because this class was not so much about Raghunuga Bhakti, this class was about... No, it wasn't. Some of it was, because a third of the chapter was. No, this class was about what? Agamaka Bhakti. Thank you. That's good. It generally wakes people up. You know, it was really funny in New Vrindavan when they had me give my seminar on sex desire. So they had me scheduled to be in a very little room. And I went to the organizers. I said, that's not going to work. I said, no way am I going to be able to be in a little room for this topic. So, yes, it does wake everybody up. Anyway, this one about Raghunuga Bhakti. Today was about Raghunuga Bhakti, and on Tuesday will be about Raghunuga Bhakti. So I'm going to save this and talk about this then. In Vaikuntha planet, all the spirit souls have the same spirit bodies as Krishna. Every person serves Vishnu with awe and reverence, all in dusty rust. So it is little impersonalism exists there. No. Oh, no. Just because when we say each of the rasas, there's subcategories, sub. So we don't read this part of Nectar Devotion in Bhakti Shastri. But Rupa Goswami goes into the categories of Dasya Ras, the categories of Sakya Ras, the categories of Vatsalya Ras, and a little bit the categories of Madhurya Ras, really in Ujjvala Nilamani, which is, like I said, part two of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Rupa Goswami goes into the subcategories of Madhurya Ras. So, just like I'm sure you've all heard, there's right-wing gopis and left-wing gopis. So each has some category. So it's not that all the servants are in the same category. Some feel a little older, some feel the same age, some feel a little younger, some of it's mixed with parental, some it's mixed a little bit with parental. There's varieties. And then of the subcategories, there's sub-sub. And then of the sub-subcategories, there's sub-sub-sub. And of the sub-sub-sub, there's sub-sub-sub-sub-sub. And each jiva has their own. You finally get sub, so you get to each jiva. And then each of us is in our own category.
Wow.
Isn't that far out? Isn't that far out? Siddhartha Goswami says in his commentary to Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 13, when the Lord chose all the Vishnu forms, that Krishna has unlimited qualities, and each jiva is attracted by one of them. Because there's unlimited jivas and unlimited qualities. And each jiva is especially attracted by one quality of Krishna. And each jiva is manifesting a particular, unique rasa that only that jiva has with Krishna. So the relationship that each of us has with Krishna, nobody else has with Krishna. It's in the 13th chapter. I don't remember the verse number. I could look it up. It's in the 13th chapter of the 10th canto, Sanatana Goswami, and I don't remember the verse number. It's where each of the cowherd boys and calves manifests as Vishnu, and they're each surrounded by all the living entities. You remember that? Down to the straws, and they're all dancing. It's in one of those verses, where it says that each of the living entities is serving according to their nature. And that it's that individual So no, it's no personalism. Constance and Shukala both envious of Krishna. It seems that both of them didn't desire for liberation. Wasn't that something Krishna were forced to liberate if they didn't desire? Oh, poor guys. They can always come back to the material world if they want. Rupees. I don't want that. You can always give it back. Have I seen any ghosts, and what are they? No, I have never seen a ghost. Thank you, Krishna. I have been in a place where there was ghosts. When we moved into the long story. Anyway, my husband and I and our oldest son, we moved into the new New York temple before anybody else did. Again, long story. And it had used to be a home for old age, it used to be an old age home for people who were old and sick. So a lot of people died there. And the three of us were the only ones in the building. Long story. And the building was really, really dirty. Like really, 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 this much dirt everywhere. And I remember at one point my husband went back to Brooklyn to get some stuff. So it was just me and my baby. And I had to put him in the stroller because it was too dirty to put him on the floor, and I'm cleaning the floor, and the elevator, or the lift, some of you call it, was going up and down by itself. And the windows were opening and closing by themselves. But I didn't see any of the ghosts. I mean, I knew they were there, but I didn't see them. What are they? It's a living entity that doesn't have a gross body, it just has a subtle body, but not like one of the higher devas who has a nice, sweet, subtle body. They're kind of stuck like a lift between floors. They're still attached to their former gross body, or they're not in a good position. They're still identifying with their former gross body.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like a ghost, let's say, they usually like present a form which they may have had in their past life.
Yes.
Like a ghost of your grandmother.
Yes.
That's that attachment.
Yes. And that was my point, that the subtle body has form. That thoughts have form. They have the same form. Okay, this one isn't related to this chapter, so I'm not going to talk about it today. Some demons Krishna is killing and sending them to hell, some to Brahmajyoti, some to Vaikuntha, and some to Goloka Vrindavan. So why is this partiality to discrimination among them when they all have common some goal? No, they're all individual. Why is he sending them to some of the... What demon did Krishna send to the hellish planet? Is there any demon that Krishna sent to the hellish planet? I don't know of any. You have to give an example. But no, it's not just discrimination, because Putana was actually acting as a mother, and Kondraka was actually meditating on the Vishnu form, and Kamsa is actually meditating on the Vishnu form. So it depends, it is very individual according to their meditation. Hopefully I'll get to talk about this later. That's totally different. That's like an old one. Okay, what triggers attraction for Krishna? Oh, that's in Nectar Devotion Part 2. Sorry. We don't do that in Bhakti Shastri. That's called the Udipans. So my humble suggestion, if you want to know what triggers attraction for Krishna, is you can go on past the Bhakti Shastri class and you can read in the next ocean. You can read the waves of the next ocean about what triggers attraction for Krishna. Ashtraya, that's beyond the scope of this class. But we can say Krishna's qualities, Krishna's form, Krishna's pastimes, and the devotees, but those are called Udipans. What is meant by meditating on the qualities? Oh, that's an easy thing to do. Devotees are so lovely, such a variety of devotees. So meditating on the qualities. So how can you not meditate on Krishna's qualities? You know, we were talking about individuality. I mean, Krishna is so interested in variety that he makes every snowflake different.
By meditating, like while chanting, you can meditate on the
form. Oh, so many times you can meditate. You can meditate while chanting, like we read the other day.
Yes. But we made it on form, service, and pastime. You can do it.
And pastime and qualities.
The qualities, what can you think of? Like, what goes in the stream of mind?
Okay. So you're sitting, right? Right now you're sitting. You're not floating. Why aren't you floating?
I don't have that.
But why aren't we all floating? Why aren't we sitting? Gravity. What's gravity?
Krishna's energy.
It's particularly Sankarsha, it's Balarama. And what is this? It's Krishna's attractive force. Krishna's attracting you to the ground. Krishna says, I'm the air of life. Are you breathing? That's Krishna. Krishna says, I'm the light of the sun. Is there some light in the room? That's Krishna. So I wrote a series of articles for Back to Godhead on earth, water, fire, air, and ether, and how you can use those to meditate on Krishna. And how you can use those to meditate on Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes. So I would refer you to those. Because you're always in touch with earth, water, fire, and ether. And they can immediately remind you of Krishna's qualities. Like air, you know, you're breathing air. And air is so subtle, you don't even know it's there. But it's so strong, it can knock over a building. It's so powerful, it's pressing on your body 14 pounds of pressure per square inch, but you're not aware it's there. So in the same way, Krishna's there, but you're not aware that he's there, but it's very powerful. So you can meditate on Krishna's qualities very easily while you're sitting anywhere. What qualities the devotees enter into different parts of the spiritual world? What are the different categories of the spiritual world? That we're getting into, and that's more again later in Nectar Devotion. That's really the later chapters of Nectar Devotion that we don't unfortunately study in this class. All right, I will not see you now for 2 days.